candidates have an incentive to maintain a level of trust with their supporters. They might use inflammatory fundraising appeals, but they want maintain a level of trust so people keep giving. Of course, Trump is the person who said he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and still maintain a level of support. And this post-election fundraising might just be the political version of that.
We want to thank you, Brendan Fischer, Director of Federal Reform at Campaign Legal Center. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
Seriously, wear a mask. It's WUSP Stony Brook, 6 o'clock Tuesday evening. Time for Off the Wall. A very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Kyle.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good.
Good to hear. as we wind down 2020.
Yourself?
I'm sorry?
Yourself?
Myself what?
Is doing...
Is there a question in there? Are you trying to ask me a question? What are you trying to ask me?
I was responding to you asking me how mm-hmm. I was doing. I said, yourself.
I don't even get a full question. I just get...
And yourself?
You're asking, how am I doing? Is that what you're asking? You're asking me how I'm doing.
I said I'm
doing. You're asking me how I am doing. Okay, Kyle, if you insist on knowing how I'm doing, I'll tell you how I'm doing. I'm not doing well. I'm doing... And here's a grammar lesson. I'm doing badly. I'm not doing bad. Most people say I'm doing bad. That's wrong. That's incorrect. I'm doing badly. The adverb is very important in that context. Yeah, I'm doing badly. I am doing very badly, in fact.
Is this the thing that happened yesterday?
Yeah, is this the thing that happened yesterday?
The internet told you there was something, and then you looked up and...
The thing that happened yesterday that won't happen again for another however many 100,000 years. Yeah. Right, maybe it's less than that. Maybe I'm exaggerating just a tad. But still, it's not going to happen again, as far as I'm concerned. Talking about the great conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn, which I've been looking forward to ever since I found out about it a couple weeks ago. And they say this could have been what guided the wise men to the birth of Jesus Christ when they saw the star in the sky. The bright star could have been a conjunction of planets and maybe another star too. And that is what led them to follow it, or just keep walking until they couldn't walk anymore. And that's what we were supposed to see yesterday. But we had clouds instead. We had cloudy weather. And we couldn't find clear skies. We looked, we asked, couldn't find them anywhere. Drove all over the place. There were people outside pointing at the sky trying to find it. Nobody could find it. Because here in the Northeast we have cloudy weather when there are important astronomical events. But you know what? Today, clear skies. And even though it's not quite the same thing, it's twice as far away, Saturn and Jupiter in the sky, it's still pretty damn close. It's still pretty damn spectacular. And the skies were clear.
So well, you were able to see it?
No, I wasn't able to see it, Kyle, because the skies weren't clear. The forecast said the skies were clear. The current conditions said the sky was clear. The sky was not clear. The sky was clear. It was clear an hour before, but as soon as the time came to go and look, that's when the clouds came as well. And you might say, oh, Emmanuel, just stop being a crybaby. Go out after the show. You know what? It sets at 7 o'clock, so yeah, that doesn't work either. And tomorrow, it's going to be so far apart, it doesn't even matter anymore. So yeah, I'm not doing well, Kyle. I'm doing very badly, because I'm frustrated. Missing great astronomical events like that, they tend to put me off. It tends to put me off.
I made brownies.
You made brownies. That's the only good thing that happened. But
sorry.
even those brownies weren't enough
to
make up for this.
No constellation.
That's supposed to be funny, a constellation, yeah.
I'm trying to put a smile on your face.
Constellations don't move. They're not animated. They're not going to do anything. They're just going to sit up there in the sky forever and look the same. I know it's not forever, but it's long enough.
Okay. You did try.
Oh, I tried.
You used all available information. Weather forecasting specifically is not. That also failed.
You know, I asked a simple question of the entire internet and every single broadcast outlet I could find. Where is there a clear sky so I can go and see this thing? I would have driven. Could not find that info anywhere. I found all kinds of data and maps and things that didn't make any sense, that weren't explained, but I couldn't find a simple answer. Where can I go to see this? Would have driven to Pennsylvania. Would have driven to Maine. Nobody could answer. And as a result, a once-in-10-lifetime event is missed. So, if anyone out there has another astronomical event That is a rarity that will never be. And I'm not talking about eclipses. We see eclipses all the damn time. I'm not talking about asteroids. Asteroids happen constantly. All right? It's got to be something big. It's got to be something that no one has seen in a long time and no one will see for a long time. I know it's a tall order. It's a tall order, but...
That was the only thing I could think of after we discussed this a little bit, and I just...
You were brainstorming. What do you have in mind?
I just want you to feel better. I don't know what event, but if something more rare occurs...
Give me some...
It's a clumsy way to frame the question.
No, I understand, though. Give me some proposals. I'll tell you if that would make me feel better. Yeah.
This disappointment could lead, actually, or could be part of... The past,
uh-huh.
when you're looking back at a moment when something astounding,
I would put this aside.
Billions and trillions of years,
I would
never see it, you know, we'll find the end of the universe.
I would forgive the heavens, and particularly the weather in the Northeast, for this, if something like that.
Okay, we find the absolute end of the universe, and there's like an exit sign or something. The emergency exit of the universe.
Something tells me you're not taking this quite as seriously as you could.
Okay. Maybe four planets align instead of two.
Yeah, but we know when the planets are going to align, and that's not going to happen. You know, they can predict these things for thousands of years. So, try again. That's not going to work.
But that's how far ahead have they predicted. Maybe there's predictions that are going to get results tomorrow. And someone's going to find out about it because they subscribe to a...
What, you mean a planet's going to go rogue or something? And
no, the calculations are still coming in, and then someone's going to mail us and say, aha, when they're writing to otw2600.com.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen. I think they've pretty much got the calculations set for a good long time. So, no, that's not going to happen. Can't be a planetary alignment.
What if they collide?
How is that going to happen? You know how far away they are?
Orbits off course.
Okay.
It goes something haywire happens.
Let me explain. The conjunction, they're not actually getting close to each other. They're just passing in front of each other from where we are. Okay, look.
Here you go.
If I was on Mars or if I was on the moon, then it would be different. Then they would align differently. But you'd have to get me there. You'd have to get me to one of those places. And I have to see it from that angle. That would be good. I would appreciate that.
So same angle.
You know what? Actually, going to Mars itself, I would appreciate that as well. You might not even need the conjunction. Just the trip to Mars might be enough. Do you see that happening? I want to come back too. I don't want to just stay there.
More so than you being able to see this once in a lifetime thing from the current vantage. But you tried. That's the most important thing.
No, that's not the most. Everyone always says that's the most important thing. It's not the most important thing. You know what the most important thing is? Succeeding. That's what the most important thing is. Trying? Yeah. It doesn't feel good to try and fail.
Look.
Not for something that's not going to happen again for another however many hundred years.
There's nothing I can say without diminishing what you're talking about. That would make you feel better other than the tall order I said. But you wait. Maybe the moon is going to, like, change colors or something.
How is that going to happen?
Or it's going to have, ads on it or something. That could happen.
Ads on the moon? You think that's going to make me feel better?
Yeah, maybe,
You know me really well.
Used car commercials on the moon, it's amazing, and we could engineer it somehow, and then you would be happy that you saw something more. No, that would have been never seen. And you might get a good deal on a used Pontiac or something. No?
Keep shoveling. Digging yourself in ever so deep. I don't know. I don't think there's... I mean, maybe a listener can help. OTW@2600.com. Maybe somebody has something that's going to happen in the next couple of years that is so spectacular, so amazing, that it'll cheer me up and make me... not regret having missed this once-in-10-lifetime opportunity to see...
Well, let's get the list,
We saw a total eclipse, and that was awesome. Total eclipse of the sun in Tennessee. And I know there are people that drove all the way to Tennessee from New York, and they were in a part of the state where it was cloudy for that moment, and they missed it. And I felt their pain then. But I can always say to them, you know what? There's another total solar eclipse in some other part of the world, which you could go to if you saved up or something. But you can't say to me there's another conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn that will be that close. You can't say that. That will happen anytime in our lifetimes. So, yeah, that's you can't cheer me up that way. So it's not going to be a conjunction. Well, unless, no, I don't think there's a conjunction of Venus, Mars, or I don't think they're passing that close to each other. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there is something. You know, this has gotten me to thinking a lot, though. This massive disappointment and realizing how the weather always messes everything up where we are. I realize, you know, this is why messiahs are never found here. You never find a damn messiah in the Northeast. You only find them in the desert. And the reason for that is because the sky is clear. The sky is always clear. And that way, you get to see the stars. And when you can see the stars, you can follow the stars. And when you follow the stars, you can find somebody in a barn someplace who just got born that you can label to be the messiah. And that'll never happen here, because the skies are cloudy and you can't follow the damn star in the first place. Yeah, that's why. If you ever wonder, it always happens in the desert.
Lunacy. It's really amazing. Well, best of luck, and better luck next time.
It's not about luck, it's about fate. And fate is always working against us.
The other example is the Borealis. You brought that up when we were discussing
all right, you know what? Yeah, the damn Borealis.
I've been
chasing that all my life. Okay, I've been to northern Norway more times than I can count. I've been to northern Canada. I've sailed across the Atlantic Ocean twice, across the Pacific Ocean once, and I have not seen those damn things once. There are people who see them all the time who don't deserve them. And I hunt them down, and I can't find them. But even if I were to find those, it would be spectacular. But, again, they exist repeatedly.
Not as unique.
Not a one-time thing. Mm. It's the one-time thing that's really kind of annoying. You know, speaking of religion, though, which people do this time of year, and it's wonderful to have these moments together where we talk about these things, I think of in Judaism is called the miracle of the oil. And we've been going through something similar to that. We're switching from one oil tank to another. And the way it works is you switch from one oil tank, you burn all the oil that's in there, and then you switch. And we've been doing this since, I think, what, September? And we've been burning the oil and figuring, okay, it's going to run out. And I didn't want to have it happen over Thanksgiving, so the poor guy has to come and do the switchover and ruin his holiday. So I was worried about that. Well, it didn't happen on Thanksgiving, and it just kept going. It just kept going. And you know what? It's still going. We thought it was going to run out. They measured it. They told us, you only have this amount. It's going to last maybe a week. That was 3 weeks ago. It's still going. We're using it. We're trying to use it. We're warming things up as much as we possibly can. We cannot burn this oil. Now, according to the legend, when Maccabees entered the temple and began to reclaim it from the Greeks, they immediately relid the Nur-Tamid, I believe is how you pronounce it, which burned constantly in the temple and has a parallel in synagogues to this day. Now, in the temple, they found a single jar of oil, which was sufficient for only one day. The messenger who was sent to secure additional oil, took 8 days to complete his mission. Took his sweet time. 8 days. But somehow that single jar of oil continued to burn until he finally got back. And that story has been told every Hanukkah since. And it's very inspirational. But I think maybe what we're dealing with here is that we're not very good at measuring how long oil lasts, you know, because they told us it's only going to last a little bit, a week maybe, and it's been lasting weeks, months even. And going back then, one day turned into 8 days. And you know what? It could have gone even longer because the guy got back. So I assume they did the cut over then. And maybe they could have burned another few days. So, yeah, that's something that we haven't really gotten better at is measuring how long oil burns for. You know, we could talk about religion and all sorts of theories and philosophies all night long, but there are other things to discuss. And it is that special time of year where we count down the days till Trump is gone and look forward to finally getting a vaccine. I've been following the news lately. I have seen certain headlines that have disturbed me, such as the Pentagon is extremely worried about what Trump is going to do next. That's literally what it said on CNN earlier. The Pentagon is worried about what Trump is going to do next.
It's on autopilot at this point. You can't help them. Like, what are we going to do to, like, help the Pentagon deal with Trump not leaving? What are we going to do to help
senior
leadership? Or what are we going to do for the government to save the government? We've paid our taxes, presumably. We've accepted whatever kind of rules have gone on. We've had a hell of a year. I mean, what collectively do they expect? We want to go get tear gas or something by protesting? I don't really care. If they can't figure it out, if they can't hold it down, if they can't, watch the door or whatever they have to do, I don't know how I appeal. I'm assuming that the people that I voted for are going to represent me, and states, the governors are going to put pressure. There's already this huge disintegration. Was it that we heard Pat Robertson, the Christian right guy, is like saying that Trump's out to lunch?
He's living in an alternate reality, I think was the quote. And
imagine.
If Pat Robertson tells you you're in an alternate reality, you're in a super-duper alternate reality. Yeah, you really are.
But statements from those people are like, those are supposed to knock sense into another chunk of his base, quote base, that is there supporting him.
I don't know. Is his base out
there?
Well,
they keep saying 70 million.
I don't see the rallies. I don't see the caravans.
They want you to think it's
crazy. I think even his base is starting to say, all right, you know, enough of this already. Let's get back to what we do usually, and this is really getting a little crazy. I hope so, anyway. I hope some sense is finally coming back, and people are realizing this guy is not playing with a full deck. But when the Pentagon says they're worried, it's not so much that he's not going to leave, because he will leave. He one way or another, he will leave. But what he will do in the time that he is legally president up until then. And it's still just under a month. And he can do all, I mentioned last, I think it was last week, that he could start ending the world. He could do all kinds of crazy things and get away with them. He could start conflicts with other countries or embrace enemies, all sorts of things that he could do, and that's what we've come to expect.
I don't know. I feel like there's still Joint Chiefs, and I mean Joint Chiefs will be influential in any kind of discussions of a provocative military action. Even if their leadership is some kind of sycophant. I don't even know who's running it. Esper's running DOD
now.
They
can't stop it, though.
But
at least, yeah.
Well, what about the legislature? I mean, they're part of this is the legacy of 9/11, the Patriot Act, or whatever they called it, whatever it turned into, gave a lot of provisions and a lot of power for unilateral action by the president. And this has only been bolstered by people like Barr, who have this absolutist thing about presidential powers. All of that aside, it would be something that I think the legislature would definitely be keen to raise the alarm, because it's their constituents that would have to go fight or that might be attacked. Maybe a territory, Guam, you know, I don't know where he's going to attack or where he would.
You think he's going to attack Guam?
Or Ukraine. No, I mean, but if you did something in Korea and you have assets in Guam, which is a territory, right, so, you know, Southeast Asia or maybe like Poland, Ukraine, you know, he's cozied up to Polish leadership and some of the cultural interests in, like, Hungary and stuff like that. But if he messes around in their backyard and, like, starts something with Russia legit, it's going to bother people in Poland and the rest of the EU.
He's not going to start anything with Russia. All right. If anything, he's going to merge with Russia. He will not criticize Russia. He'll blame China. He'll blame Iran. He'll blame everybody.
Right.
He'll never blame Russia. I don't know why people need to have this hammered into their heads constantly. There's obviously something going on there. There's enough evidence to support Russia being behind countless things.
The point is, he puts people in jeopardy. It's going to be a couple phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
So he can't not care when people from states like Texas, they're saying, hey, you know, you're starting something that's going to end up costing lives, and you didn't even ask if we could. Whether you have the right from some arcane turn-of-the-century thing or you don't and you just ignore it, he's going to hear about any kind of action like that. So that's an international dispute, right? I mean, then what is the other worst-case scenario? Domestic stuff. Well, how could he have screwed up this country anymore?
Oh, yes. Well,
what's left?
I'm glad you mentioned that because, there still is quite a lot of potential.
Well, it's a thought experiment.
There's a lot of potential because of what he is doing right now, and we are seeing it. He's not letting go of this election fantasy of his, and he's being enabled by countless people around him, including our own Lee Zeldin here on Long Island, who continues to support the overturning of a democratic election. We are seeing so many people do that. It's frightening, and it's not going to just disappear when he does. That is the lasting harm that is being dealt to this nation, to every single one of us.
See, this is why I think some of the actions coming up in January, I think he was promoting some action. Is it the 5th? They're going to try to act. And that itself, he's going to create some event like that that then gets disrupted, that then becomes cause for martial law. That's the play for domestic.
Well, the talk is that there were discussions in the White House with all kinds of psychopaths that he is now drawing closer to about imposing martial law, and also about having a massive rally in D.C.
That's the pretense.
Right.
I mean, he saw how it worked with BLM stuff and George Floyd protests and the upheaval. So he knows if he creates an event like that, that is then countered, which inevitably it will, or bad actors or whomever will go to make it seem as though it's being counter-protested. I mean, that in and of itself is fraught, and we've yet to really go through how that went down across the country over the spring and summer. Without the ability to do the analysis, say that happens, would that be a pretense for a federal martial law? I mean, that's really what he thinks could, because he has a little dust-up at his rally in D.C., he can then dictate that the entire country needs to be punished or patrolled.
He will still be very much in power at that point. And it's January 6th, by the way, is when this is happening. And, you know, basically they've already filed the application. It's probably going to be pretty big. Probably going to be pretty big and probably going to be just as ugly as the previous ones, where they attack black churches and have ugly chants and have all kinds of racist people congregating. Just frightening everybody, because what does this mean? What does this mean to democracy?
Yeah, it'll be like posturing to the nth degree, and it then becomes sort of this, I don't know, a little bit of a conflict for Democrats or whomever, anybody, any American really, who's like, what the heck is going on? So they have to either resist this by demonstrating and being in their face, or avoid it completely and ignore it and hope it goes away. Either way, I mean, I'm not saying either is noble or one is better than the other, but it's hard not to want to do both. I gotta say, just in light of it, and I mean, yeah, let them act on their own, but okay, so they go and destroy churches and stuff without resistance. What is that allowing? I mean, it's a real tight spot if it does. But when I heard the announcement of that, basically I just realized, oh wow, that is so ripe for becoming a pretense. And so I really hope people are thoughtful and creative, and they are outnumbered and either chased out of town or whatever happens. I don't know. I mean, that's a bad direction.
I think what you say is right. Outnumbering them, I think that is the strongest thing you can possibly do.
Because they have been in a lot of other actions in the
States. But here's the thing: if you don't show up, that works against us because that makes them strong. That makes them be able to do this kind of thing without any kind of backlash, and they think the people are with them. If you show up and attack them, well then you become the violent demonstrators. You become the problem, and as Carl was saying, an excuse for martial law, perhaps. I certainly understand why it makes sense to react this way, but it's playing into their hands, just like chanting defund the police or socialist slogans plays into their hands. We have to be smart about these approaches.
Well, if you don't want to go, maybe there's things you can do remotely, moderating or monitoring what's being said and the kinds of things that are going on from afar. You can still be involved. I just think that, there's got to be a lot of coordination, a lot of thought put into how there is a counter voice and a counterpoise
but
to them.
This day, January 6th, is the day that Congress is supposed to confirm that Trump lost the 2020 election. Now, there are still congressmen and maybe even senators that are vowing to fight that against all facts, and that will only strengthen what's going on in the streets at the same time. Now, their application, which I'm looking over right now, says that they expect 5,000 people. Even I know they're going to get more than 5,000 people. So I don't know if that's a lie. I don't know if that's a tactic. But
probably to get the permit, right?
Yeah, well, maybe if they said they're expecting 50,000 people, they wouldn't get the permit.
Or they wouldn't get the permit. They'd have to do crazy amount of insurance or other kinds of traffic hiring and checking. Do they keep it at like a sort of believable number? Maybe they can get in just below a certain threshold. Details aside, this is going to be really important to not fall into as a trap and also not allow. And it ought to be in the dustbins of history. So hopefully that is not what we're fearing, but it just seems so ripe for exploiting, and it's just such a canned, like a planted event. It's not they're not doing it for what they're saying. They're doing it to trigger people and cause something. It just seems so planted for that, you know, like a honeypot, a lib honeypot, you know.
Thing is, there could have been a transition, a way to gracefully salvage a lot of what this country has been founded on, and move forward. I don't see that happening anymore. I don't see Trump acting in a logical manner and continuing to lead people down a road that is not going to end well. What does he do at this point? He can't concede. He won't concede. He's never going to do that. He's not going to participate in any kind of transition. He probably won't be at the inauguration ceremony, which is fine. But think about the message that sends to people everywhere. It's going to be a scar that will take a long time to heal, and can result in all kinds of other mayhem along the way. Cooler heads really need to prevail on all sides, and I just hope that the people who have followed him in the past start to get a reality check and realize this is not right. This is not how things are supposed to work. And he's not playing with a full deck. We need to get through this together when we need to start rebuilding next month. Now, of course, COVID continues. The numbers are just so staggering. They almost seem meaningless because they keep going up. They keep going up. They don't stop. And I don't want to become numb to that, but I feel like we all are. We're just seeing these numbers, they get higher every day, and we look back 6-7 months ago, and we were filled with horror when the numbers were a fraction of what they are now. Yeah, you know, a friend of mine, I heard from a friend of mine who actually turned out got COVID over the summer. You know how there are people that you just don't want to get into it. You just can't keep the conversation going because they buy into this. They buy into the propaganda, the false facts that are out there. And I mean, we all have this with our families. How often can you make the same points? If facts are not accepted, what do you have left? There's nothing you can use to bolster your argument if your sources of facts aren't taken seriously. And this friend of mine who even got COVID doesn't think it's that serious. Which, you know, that's going down Trump lane there, because yeah, he got COVID and he thinks he's above it all now, and led a whole bunch of Republicans down that road as well, led all kinds of people, many of whom did not make it, because that's not how it works. And comparing this to the flu, as my friend did, there's a flu vaccine every year, yet we still have the flu. So it's not going to end with the vaccine. 25,000 USA deaths on average. I don't believe the COVID-19 vaccine's 95% effective, coming from those that stand to profit the most. Well, I have the same doubts about pharmaceuticals and people making a buck off of this, but you can't compare COVID to the flu. It's not the same thing. First of all, flu vaccines only work on a small percentage. I think it's something like 30%. That is what you're dealing with year after year. And 25,000 people, it's a fraction. It's less than a tenth of what we've seen with COVID-19. And, you know, invariably, the people that will tell you this right now, that there's it's like the flu and we're going to have it for a while, they were the same people that were saying it's nowhere near what the flu is. If you go back to the spring, when we only had a couple of hundred people, well, we have 25,000 people a year that die from the flu. It's not like that. Well, now it's well past that, as predicted. And then, invariably, it's the media that gets scared, that gets blamed into scaring us. The media is trying to scare the crap out of us. Well, you know what? I'm not listening to the media. I'm listening to the medical professionals. I'm listening to the scientists. I'm listening to people who know what they're talking about. And comparing this to other large amounts of deaths, as my friend did, rightfully so too, 250,000 medical malpractice deaths every year. That's a big deal. But to say it's not being reported in the media, it's in the media. You can find stories everywhere. The third leading cause of death in the U.S. that most doctors don't want you to know about. Look it up. 250,000 deaths per year because of mistakes by doctors, by medical people, misdiagnoses. It's there. It's fact. Nobody's trying to deny that. So let's stop trying to deny what COVID-19 is doing. The other thing, medical malpractice, it's not contagious. It's not something you can catch by breathing in the same air. COVID-19 is. It's not the media. Yeah, the media is trying to scare the crap out of us. That is their job. That's what they do. It sucks, but that's what they do. In this case, they're right. In this case, we should be scared. In this case, we should be following the guidelines that have been suggested to us by people who really know what they're talking about, and people who should be respected because they spent a lifetime learning and teaching and helping to treat people. And the fact that we're in a society right now where that is cheapened and compared to idiots on Newsmax that don't know what the hell they're talking about, that is shameful. That is shameful. So it really bugged me that somebody who actually got the disease still isn't taking it seriously, still doesn't think that it's any worse than anything else. There are lots of bad things out there. Just because something kills a lot of people doesn't negate the other thing that's killing a lot of people.
In an emergency, that is actually something we're here to do as a radio station. And a lot of the other organizations people have been hearing from during this crisis is important to get updates, to get the latest, because things were so uncertain and things were changing so quickly. That information had to get out. That's something that we committed to doing. That's something that all of those cable programs you might fault are tasked with doing as an essential part of the communication system. I mean, if you want to get technical about it, it is the most important thing for the media to do in a moment like that, to get people not upset so much as informed and outraged and vigilant. And it might be a tough conversation, but it's critical. If we were not emphasizing the things we were, if we were not working hard to broadcast news conferences from the governors, from the county officials, that was stuff we were committed to doing as a radio station, and a lot of people worked really hard to do that. A lot of newspapers, a lot of people were putting together graphs and you know, statistics, as much information as they could, so that people were armed with the information, so that, yeah, they might hear some scary news, but they can put it in a greater context because they have as much as possible. So I find that knee-jerk, like, blaming the media, that may be really easy to do in a lot of other situations, but to say that it's for the media to not have said things that might seem a little scary would have been the media falling down on their job. And I can't hear that from the work we've done, and just our own struggle personally, but also just trying to be a part of the greater good as far as keeping people informed. It's something we were happy to do in the context of it, and we're not going to stop.
The media may get some of the facts wrong. You may not like the personalities that are presenting those facts, but it's being laid out there for you to interpret, for you to decide upon, and that is so much better than simply omitting it. And if you want to compare, the media may be scaring you a bit, giving you things that you don't want to hear, things that you might think are overblown, but here are the facts, here are the statistics, you interpret them yourself, versus not hearing it at all, versus what our president has done, where he doesn't even talk about it anymore, where all these hundreds of thousands of people dying doesn't matter, and where the fact that they died in the first place, something that likely could have been avoided had we been on top of this from the beginning. Which would you prefer? You know, I prefer a little bit of shocking headlines that might get my attention, that I might be able to dismiss if some facts get carried along with that, rather than it being completely kept from me so I don't know anything and I have to go and discover it myself, or where I basically equate everybody and say, well, it's Newsmax is the same as CNN, is the same as OAN. Every single media outlet is worthy of my respect. That's not true at all. In fact, most of them aren't even real media outlets in the first place. They're blogs or websites. They're not the same thing. I know we all want to be the media, but hey, you know, it's a real job. It takes real skill and a lot of dedication, commitment. You can't just stick a label on something and say, yeah, we're the same as whatever, Meet the Press or 60 Minutes or whatever.
Or somebody's game stream on whatever platform they publicize. It is not just coming from, it's not incidental. And I mean, there are because of fragmentation and a lot of the different technologies that allow like multicasting, everybody kind of not, instead of getting a couple sources broadcasting, you have a couple sources broadcasting and everybody else sort of microcasting, and that's great. But just like advertising and stuff found various vulnerabilities and you got sort of misleading ads, it's been the same way in so far as new apps or new, in this case, streaming platforms or news platforms coming up on a streaming platform. They kind of look like something, but they're not actually that thing. That has, I think, been a direct result of the saturation, the fragmentation of traditional media, but there's a lot of different factors. And of course, local newspapers, consolidation leading to publications and outlets being owned by one major source and then not having a lot of alternatives. All of those factors really hurt the trusted sources in each state and each city. Mm-hmm. And it has led, I think, to this this place where people will think a clickbait news site is a legitimate source just because it kind of looks like what they would have thought a traditional newspaper that had a website was in the past. And as you said, they're just, you cannot equate them at all. But this is part of news literacy and media literacy and being able to understand what you're looking at.
Local media is essential, and that's something that has to be protected and valued as much as possible. Case in point, I don't think there's a single Long Island television newscast anywhere. I honestly don't think. We have Long Island TV stations. I don't think there was a single Long Island, I mean, there's News 12, of course. That's a cable channel. But I'm talking about broadcast. And there are so many broadcast news outlets for New York City, so close, and other main areas, but not Long Island. Why is that? That's an example. And just think of all the newspapers that have disappeared over time, places where you can rely on the people reporting the news to have done their job. And maybe they haven't done the job as well as they could, but they're certainly doing a better job than just every Tom, Dick, and Harry running a website. All right, we are out of time for this, but it is time for our special feature. And that will be Films of the Year That Was, where we venture back into time and journey into Academy Award-winning film land, where we watch an Academy Award-winning film for every year, starting back when they began and ending when they finish. And are we going to start with the domestic film or the foreign film?
Domestic.
All right, The Littlest Emperor is the film that we saw.
The Last Emperor.
Did I get that wrong? The Last Emperor, not The Littlest Emperor. Yeah, I thought, okay. You're right, The Last Emperor. What was I thinking?
At the 60th Academy Awards, won 9 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director.
He was little, though. He was a little emperor.
Oh, yeah, he was little, really.
He was tiny, 3 years old.
Yeah.
I learned so much from this film. Oh, my God, I learned an incredible amount. I leared about the whole imperial dynasty of China that lasted up until, I think, 1911 for 2,000 years. And then one day, the Chinese people just got sick of it and said, you know, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to go, you know, have a republic instead. But the emperor continued to live in the Forbidden City, unaware that that had happened. And talk about living in a fantasy world or an alternate reality. That's what he was doing. And he basically moved around and became allied with the Japanese after they invaded Manchuria in China and did some nasty things and was eventually arrested by the communist Chinese when they won back their land, but then released and allowed to just become a regular person. I thought that was incredible.
He was coerced by his interrogators to formally renounce his forced collaboration with the Japanese invaders for war crimes during the Second Sino-Japanese War.
Shouldn't you do that, though? Shouldn't you renounce?
No.
If you collaborate with the Japanese who have invaded your homeland?
It's a small price, yeah. That's true.
I was surprised they just let him go, and he was able to just become a gardener, which is a pretty cool thing for an emperor to become.
He had to watch a film detailing the wartime atrocities. Anyway.
Well, that's what we did. So
it was
I think they should have focused more on that part of his life, though, what the bad things he did. Yeah, you know, he basically got involved in greed and gluttony and things like that. But he also he hurt a lot of people. He became the fake emperor of that part of Manchuria. The Japanese took advantage of him. It was a very interesting story. But, you know, I learned a lot about how China was basically, the modern China was formed. After the emperor was kicked out, basically all of China became the Republic of China, which is what Taiwan is now. And the communist Chinese in the 40s, after World War II, they basically took over the mainland. Now, the Republic of China, currently Taiwan, was not a very nice place. It was pretty much fascist, and the communist Chinese regime was actually seen as better, you know, more fair. So it's interesting to see how that evolved over the years. Very very interesting film, very long film.
It was really fantastic. Trying to get the period just right with so many ancient costumes and telling the story over the entirety of his life from dynastic, like early days to sort of the modern and postmodern wartime eras. It just was a real fun thing to see, and beautiful quality as well in some of these modern copies. So
what was amazing was that Bernardo Bertolucci, Italian director who made the film, was granted full access to the Forbidden City by the communist Chinese. And he said, or people in his production said, that it was easier to work with them than it was to work with Hollywood. There were less notes, there were less demands, and they really were quite open to having the story told. And what the result is, an incredible film with unprecedented footage. This is not some Hollywood backlot. This is the real thing.
Over 19,000 extras were needed over the course of the film, it says here.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, just we could go on and on, but I don't want us to run out of time. For our international treat.
Oh, that, yes.
We found out just today was by a director of a similar or a movie we talked about, but the best picture for an international film is Babette's Feast.
Babette's Feast.
Or Babette's Gæstebud.
From Denmark.
Yes, it's Danish. That was the Danish title. Produced, let's see.
What we discovered was that this story was written by the same person who wrote Out of Africa, the Academy Award-winning film from a couple of years ago. I didn't know that. That really threw me for a loop.
Oh, that's what you said. Yeah, it was written. I'm sorry. This was directed by Gabriel Axel. I don't know that director. But it was about, a woman who comes to work for a house of these two old spinster types, and they have a very, very small town, and she ends up helping in their kitchen, sort of, or as a domestic worker.
They were, I don't want to say depressing, but it was this very religious community, very small, very isolated religious community in Denmark in the 1800s. And you see them earlier in their life, too. You see them when the two sisters, when their father was alive, and this community of I think they're Lutherans.
It's called a pietistic conventicle.
Yeah, of course it is.
And you know what? That just the way you have to pronounce that is exactly the kind of austere and conservative. Yeah, it was just very restrained.
Each sister had a chance to have a life, to be courted by somebody and go someplace else. And each time they chose to stay and help their father with this religious community instead. And then I think something like 30 years passed, and Babette shows up at their door then, because there's a Franco-Prussian war.
Yes.
That took place, and she's sent by one of the suitors, one of the spurned suitors of one of the sisters. She is sent there to live safely because it isn't safe for her in Paris anymore, and that's Babette. And she says, "I'll work for you for free, and I'll cook for you, and all that kind of thing." And she has, I don't know how this works exactly, but she has a lottery ticket that gets renewed every year back home. And one day, that lottery ticket pays off, and she has 10,000 francs. So the assumption is that she's going to go and spend that someplace. But instead, she decides that she wants to pay back the sisters and the community by making them this lavish French dinner, which that is Babette's feast. Now, these pious religious people are so afraid of something extravagant like that, they think it's the work of Satan. That this all this food of various,
and they see all the animals and the critters being,
and wine and all sorts of things like that.
It's all hedonistic, and they can't handle it.
They make a vow that they're not going to say anything about the food. They're going to just get through the meal and not be tempted. And that's exactly what they are, the most boring group of people I could ever imagine hanging out with. And they have one of the suitors who was I think the German military or Austrian military. He's one of the guests, and he is the only person that didn't take that vow, who realizes, wow, this is really good food. This is done amazingly well. The only other time I had food like this was at this place called Café Anglais, which actually did exist in the 1800s in Paris, where this French chef basically made this incredible food, and he's the only one commenting. Everybody else is just they're feeling the effects of the food. They're getting more friendly with each other and putting aside all differences and things like that. You see it's really having an effect on them, but they don't really say anything nice to Babette herself, who's working tirelessly in the kitchen. And in the end, it's revealed that she was in fact that same French chef from Café Anglais in Paris. How about that?
The meal was a 7-course meal consisting of turtle soup, portage à la tourte, blini d'Emmendorf, buckwheat pancakes with caviar and sour cream, served with a Veuve Clicquot champagne.
And there are restaurants that serve that actual menu, Babette's Feast.
Yeah.
And in the end, she reveals that she spent all of her lottery winnings on that meal, because for 12 people at Café Anglais, it cost 10,000 francs. Yeah. So, you stuck with me. I'm poor again.
And that's it. It's basically just about how her devotion, I think, to this new life. And ultimately, maybe an acceptance, but like a yearning for your own past.
Yeah.
Which has kind of wistful, weird religious undertones. I think there is, you know, grace in thinking on your sins, and maybe there is something there for her in her becoming a part of this community, bringing some of her past to treat a community that is enabling her.
They should have said thanks, though,
for her
hospitality. They should have been nicer.
She returns with her hospitality. I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
In the end, good food is always the answer, I think. Okay, we are out of time. I'm still upset at missing the conjunction. And hopefully we'll find something to make up for it.
There's plenty of other things in the universe.
Well, I found a good song that talks about planetary conjunction. But okay. It's the wrong planets. It's the wrong damn planets, McCartney. So there's that. But it doesn't matter because I didn't see the planets anyway.
Well, good talking to you.
You too. You too. OTW@2600.com. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening.
Good night.
Standing in the hall of the great cathedral, waiting for the transport to come. Starship 2-1.